the devil awakens.
Maximus wrests his life from the underworld.
Hey boy, what in the world are you doing here?
He was elated with his escape.
I wanted out.
I set out now in a box upon the sea.
I'm really happy to be able to introduce our fellow Gloucester Writers' Center board member, Greg Gibson, old friend. Gregor and Anne-Marie were some of the first people I met after moving to Gloucester in the 70s. And so I thought I'd just give a little background information instead of literary stuff. So the Crotty Gibsons lived in this funky place on Bass Ave that just recently got torn down about a few weeks ago. And you could see, as if you're driving down Bass Ave up on the right, there was like this dollhouse opened up, and you could see Brooks and Galen's bedroom there. I wanted to stop and go in and see what the painting was on the wall, but I was getting honked at too much, so I had to keep going down the line. When I first met Gregor, I didn't know he was a writer, but he liked Thelonious Monk, Ballantine Ale, and Olson, so I knew he had good taste. So he wrote that I came to Gloucester in 67 to go fishing, and I decided I'd be there the rest of my life. I don't know if he caught any fish, but he got tangled up in Gloucester's net, and we're glad he did. He later joined the Navy, spent a hitch on the West Coast, and there he started to read Olson and Raymond Chandler. Out of the Navy, he came back to Gloucester, met Anne-Marie, and they started a family. In 76, Jean Radoslavich invited Greg to open a bookstore at her art gallery. So with $100 worth of secondhand books, he started 10 Pound Island Book Company. Over the years, he carved out a business specializing in old and rare maritime books and manuscripts, and later he began publishing, bringing out important local history like Dana Story's Frame Up and Vincent Farini's autobiography, Hermit of the Clouds. In 1977, Gregor was hired by Jonathan Bayliss for a newly created CETA-funded Arts and Humanities project. I remember that pretty well because I was hired as well, and it was the year of the paycheck. Yes, it was, as I recall, it was $183 a week clear every week. So thank you, Jonathan Bayliss, and thank you, Jimmy Carter, for the CETA deal. On that, Greg dove into the history of Cape Ann. He created an index to the bibliography of Cape Ann literature that was originally compiled by Robert Brown a decade earlier. And you can check that out at www.10pound.com. The bibliography contains thousands of citations from books, maps, monographs, periodicals, and it's a great research tool for anyone looking into Cape Ann history. There's still more to do on that, eh? There's always more to do, yes. So soon after that wonderful year of the paycheck ended, I ended up spending a lot of time with Greg on 32-foot ladders, painting Cape Ann's wooden homes and drinking a lot more Ballantine. He never spoke about writing, literature we talked about, but I didn't really know that he wrote. He was certainly one of the most thoughtful people I knew, but I didn't know that he was writing. But at the end of 1992, the Gloucester community was shocked by the news that Greg and Anne-Marie's son Galen was murdered, the victim of a random shooting of a guy run amok. So this shock led Greg to a seven-year journey to write a book about this horrendous event. Gone Boy, A Walkabout, met with critical success. Entertainment Weekly called it the best book of 1999. And Greg says that the fascination, the satisfaction derived from writing convinced him that he should write another one. So next came Demon of the Waters, the true story of the mutiny of the whale ship Globe. And the book tells the story of a grisly mutiny on an American whaling ship, and that was well reviewed. The Times, New York Times, not the Gloucester Times, who doesn't seem to want to review any of Greger's books, deemed it worthy contribution of literature and whaling. In 2008, a fellow book dealer found an old wooden trunk filled with photographs of slideshow freaks, diaries, jazz, and told Greg his story, and it was off to the races again. The book charts the struggle to authenticate the photos Bob Langmuir believes are the early studies by Diane Arbus. This leads him on a wild journey from a Bronx cold storage facility to Jack Dracula, a former sideshow freak, to the curator's office of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. All along, Greg keeps the reader wrapped with his insight into this crazy milieu and the people who populate this little piece of outsider America. Bookman writer Larry McMurtry said, "Herbert's freaks will fascinate those among us who are continually stimulated by the richness and variety of American subcultures." He devoured it, and I'm sure many of you in this room did as well. There's a nice interview on Greg's site where he says, "I think humor is really important, and if there is a way to be accurate and just say something, or a way to be accurate and make a person smile or think twice or scratch his head, then I choose the latter." So with that, here comes the old Turk's Load. And like Freaks, it's a wonderful read. And I found myself laughing out loud, especially if you know some of the characters. He began writing the novel way in the way back. It got out of the gate fast with Pyramid Books taking an interest. But a then younger, greener, not so sagacious Gibson let the fish get tied up on some rocks and it got away. Then he tinkered with it for decades, and back a few years ago, being the publisher he is, he published it himself and gave it to folks for the holidays. And soon after that, this guy, Otto Penzler, who started a mysterious bookshop in Manhattan, has his own imprint on Grove Atlantic and has published writers like Isaac Asimov, Mickey Spillane, Raymond Chandler, Robert Bloch, and Greg Gibson.
Thank you, Henry, and thank you, the Bookstore of Gloucester and the Gloucester Writers' Center, and thank you also the Gloucester Writers' Center, who has made so much possible for so many people in this community. It's a wonderful endeavor, and if you haven't thought of supporting it, I hope that you will soon. I will now recapitulate everything that Henry has said. In 1969, I was on a ship in the U.S. Navy sailing up and down the west coast of North America. And the term of my service was about what you'd get for a classy felony, breaking and entering aggravated assault. And so I had plenty of time on my hands, and I resolved to use this time in an effort to improve myself. So I undertook the study of Homeric Greek so that I might read the Iliad and the Odyssey in their original tongue. And I studied the work of Ezra Pound and Charles Olson. And I studied the work of those three great modern masters who, after 4 years as an English major in a rather prestigious East Coast Liberal Arts College. I had never heard mentioned once. Specifically, Hammett, Chandler, and James M. Cain. Well, it happened that since I was the only sailor in the repair division who could read, write, and operate an IBM Selectric typewriter, I was given the task of compiling the daily watch bill for the ship. And this job came with certain benefits, specifically in exchange for a good place on the watch bill, my shipmates would render services or products. And in particular, I had this one buddy, he was a machinist mate, his name was Ellis, and he was a lovely guy, but he was tragically fat. And it got so bad, he loved to eat, and it got so bad that his chief sent him to the infirmary, and the medic there prescribed him diet pills, which he would deliver to me. Every week. In exchange for a favorable place on the watch bill, hatfuls of diet pills. And at about this time, I came into possession of a brick of hashish, roughly the size and shape of half a salami. All of which contributed to my studies of Homeric Greek, the writings of Ezra Pound and Charles Olson, and the studies of those three great masters, Hammett, Chandler, and James M. Cain. It didn't take long to realize that I was never going to be able to learn. I didn't learn a word of Homeric Greek. And I had very little idea what Pound and Olson were talking about. But the three great modern masters, Hammett, Chandler, and Cain, spoke to me. Indeed, it was as if I'd heard my native tongue for the first time. So, of course, at some point shortly thereafter, I sat myself down in front of the IBM Selectric typewriter and resolved to create an homage to the three great modern masters, Hammett, Chandler, and James M. Cain. A guy wakes up from a blackout drunk in bed with a gorgeous blonde. And he has no idea how he got there, but he says, "Boy, I must have done something right." And he leans over to get a look at her, honeyed hair flowing over the pillow. And he sees that she's a guy. A hippie with a beard and long hair. And he's got a bullet hole in his chest, and he's dead. And sirens are wailing outside, and someone's pounding on the door. Well, I don't really remember what happened in that story, but I do remember that it was 18 and a half single-spaced pages long, and that my shipmates loved it. And this inspired me to hope and dream that I might someday be able to create a work worthy of those three great modern masters, Hammett, Chandler, and James M. Cain. So I sat down in front of the IBM Selectric and started typing, but all I could get was like scenes. I mean, a guy at a bar, a guy answering the telephone, somebody meeting somebody. They were good, the writing was good, but they were like, and I mean, I thought of them as pearls, but they were unstrung. So when I got out of the Navy in 1971, I lost my electric typewriter. I set about trying to string those pearls, and I worked. And then at some point, I had a novel. I mean, I got some kind of sequence, something, and I thought, this is good. And I called it in honor of Saul Bellow's great novel, The Dangling Man. I called it The Dangling Dick. And I had many, many copies made down at Frederick's there. I remember the guy who ran the Xerox machine looked at it and just got this smile on his face. Oh, I know what you're up to. And then I sent it out to every publisher that I could find in those magazines about writing that even then existed. They call it Over the Transom, sent in with absolutely no introduction, just cold, like a cold call. And I didn't know then, but I know now, of course, that nobody even reads those things. They just get thrown away. So it was miraculous that some months later I got a letter from Pyramid Publishing Company, and they said they liked my writing, and they thought I had talent, but they couldn't buy my book because the American public would never, ever accept a detective hero who was an alcoholic. But they invited me to come down to New York and discuss the realities of the publishing business. And I was so innocent and so full of testosterone and so stupid that instead of being overjoyed, I was furious. Who were they to fuck with my deathless prose? And did they think they'd turn me into a New York hack? I don't think so. And there it went. But in fairness, Anne-Marie and I had just had our first kid, and you know, I knew I needed to do something more remunerative than stringing pearls. So I would have let the whole thing go, except right about that time, I had a religious vision. It's February, early in the morning, and it's sleeting, and it's dark, and it's cold, and there's a bad east wind, and I've got a hangover. And I'm waiting on the corner of Duncan and Rogers Streets for Mac Bell to show up so I can help him move some ridiculous piece of furniture to the glass. And I'm shivering. And I look down Rogers Street, and all at once I'm suffused with a warmth, and this thing comes into my head all at once, and it is that we're born and we suffer and we die. And life is so fucking hard that if I could do anything to provide my fellow human beings with just a few hours of distraction from this suffering and misery that we endure, I would be making the best and highest use of whatever talents God gave me. So then I went on to write a book about the murder of my son, and then another book about a psychopath who tortures and kills several people on his whaling ship, and then another book about a guy who goes crazy because he falls in love with a woman who's committed suicide 20 years before. I was working toward it, but I can't say I was fulfilling the terms of my vision. So the old Turk was constantly there, perhaps as a way to redeem myself. And I kept, I'd come back to it, and I tried to fix it. I needed to be bigger, and I needed to straighten the characters out. And the plots in novels are horrible. It's like trying to assemble a machine while it's running. It's just, you just can't. And I had all these characters come through. I was like a Broadway producer starting a play, and the actors would come in. And you know, most of them washed out, but there were some really terrific ones who stuck, like these two thugs from the Tenderloin in San Francisco, Turk and Eddie, named after the streets in Tenderloin. And they were great. And it took me years to realize that they were in love with one another, that they were gay. I mean, thugs don't. And yet, you spend enough time with these people and you get to know them. And so I kept trying to make this thing bigger. One time I tried to write a chapter from the vantage point of Telstar, the satellite. I was really trying to get this thing done. And we're talking, 1969, 1979, 1989. And maybe it was around 1999. I was talking to my old friend, Fred Buck, probably about Skippy Cream's murder, which is a book in itself that needs to be written. And it came to me, if I put Fred or his persona in this book and Gloucester was in this book, it would expand it in just the way that I needed it to be expanded. So I asked Fred if he'd let me borrow his persona. And he said he would work for Scotch Whiskey. And I assented to this arrangement. He specified the brand, and I went in search of it. And I remember it was so expensive. I can't remember the name of this stuff. It had a lot of O's and U's and I's in it. And it was made in Scotland. And it was so expensive, it came in a wooden box. And I remember asking the purveyor of this high-end stuff if it was any cheaper without the box, and him looking at me like I was an insect. But I got the stuff to Fred, and man, he helped me so much. I mean, he gave me lines, literally, that I use in the book, and he taught me about the mailman business, and he taught me about throat cancer. And then I went to Addison Gilbert. Tom Pierce got me into the reference library, and I learned all about how they treated throat cancer in the 60s and what kind of drugs you used for that, and so forth and so on. And then at some point, there's sometimes you work on stuff and you could just work forever, and there's sometimes you work on stuff and a moment comes and you just know you're done. And, you know, I got to a point with this thing and then I knew I was done. So I sent it to my agent and she read it and she said, I can't sell this. It sounds just like Hammett or Shannon. She was an Indian, not American Indian, and very bright, and I love her. But she totally didn't get it. She didn't get it. She didn't get the homage aspect of it. And then, this could only happen in the 21st century. I said, well, fuck it, I'll just publish it myself. And I made it into a perfect replica of a 1950s paperback pulp magazine. I even stole the cover from a bookseller colleague of mine, Jason Lovello, who deals in this stuff, hooked me up with this cover of a book called The Drug Pusher. And that's the cover of the Old Turk's Load. And I had Walch Printing print me up a couple hundred, and I sent them out to my friends and, you know, colleagues. And some of my friends were in the publishing business, and one of them, Otto Penzler, read it, liked it, and bought it. So, you know, when you sign a contract for a book, especially a book like a mystery book, they always ask you, well, you know, do you have any more? Because they like these serious things. You got another one? And I said, yeah, it'll be ready in 40 years. And they didn't get it. But the biggest satisfaction, aside from having finally fulfilled this vision, I mean, when I get to the gates and they say, you know, what have you done? I'll say, well, I was able to to provide some small distraction for millions of people in this suffering world. And they'd say, of course, well, actually, Greg, that was hundreds, but you did your best, come on in. That was the celestial high point. The mundane, the earthly high point was when I went back to my agent and I said, you remember that book that you couldn't sell? Well, I sold it. So write us up a contract. And she took her 15%, but it was the sweetest 15% that I've ever parted with. So that's that. I will now read from this book, although I must say I don't, this reading thing, Charlotte was the one who crystallized it. For this reading thing is like, what is, I mean, I write them. You're supposed to read them. I'm going to stand up here. I'm going to read you my book now, and then we can go to bed. But I will read a few, two short chapters that, what's that verb? Not explicate, but that, you know, describe the character of the central, sorry? Exemplify. Very good. Thank you. You'll get an A this term. Construction of the central character, the detective Walkaway Kelly. And this chapter is called Let It Be, Leave It Alone. Although he'd spent most of his life in Manhattan, Walkaway Kelly emerged from his building as if he were landing on an alien planet. The rock beneath him and at his sides surged as he walked in massive, dizzying waves that disappeared when he stopped to watch them roll. Menace hung in the air, a sense of imbalance. He put his head down and trudged east on 53rd, aware that something had seriously disrupted the invisible currents guiding him through the world, probably the mess he'd gotten into with the transvestite hooker and the German tourist. It hadn't felt right at the time, but events had swept him along, and now he was on the other side, lying low, as if there were a chance of staying out of fate's way. 8 days before, outside the five spot, a statuesque hooker and her John had brushed past. Tight dress, big hair, long legs, fuck me heels. Perfect, except for her Adam's apple, but there was nothing to be done about that. When Kelly spotted the hooker at New Lefty's later that night with another guy, he was curious enough in an amused sort of way to sit a few seats down the bar from them and listen, checking them out every so often in the mirror behind the bottles. The new John had a heavy accent and was seriously drunk. He was a head shorter than the impressive she creature and kept putting his face into her chest as he spoke, trying to nuzzle her. They disappeared after a while. Not long after that, Kelly paid for his drink and departed, figuring that was that, but it wasn't. As he passed the alley outside, he heard a noise that stopped him, because it was not the noise that would have been made by a German tourist with an ampule of amyl nitrate in his nose being blown by a good-looking transvestite who'd already slipped his wallet out of his pocket and was figuring out how to peel off his Rolex while he came. It was a squeak of mortal terror. Something different was going down. Instantaneously, Kelly had the image of the other guy, the first John he'd seen with her, no John at all. The two of them were working the German over, going for the hotel key, passport, and traveler's checks. It seemed perverse to Kelly, using violence where sex would do. He called out for correction. He turned down the alley and found the hooker in front of a dumpster with the now limp German in a headlock, blood running from his nose. Her partner was going through his pockets. The hooker saw him first. Fuck off, asshole. The other guy turned to face him. Kelly was in the groove now, and events were proceeding in slow motion like the beginning of a car crash. He could see the punk trying to make him, trying to decide if he was a cop or not, and rendered that question moot by kicking him in the groin. The hooker dropped the German and came around in front of Kelly with a knife. She was headed for the end of the alley, and she slashed at him to clear her path. He stepped out of the blade's way, but the other guy rolled under his knees, and Kelly fell back on the cobblestones, knocking his head so hard little stars came out. He knew he might go under. Then they'd do him. That was when it dawned on him that he should have let it be. Left it alone. The whole intervention had been the result of too much time on his hands. This was the kind of thing that happened when you forced matters. He pushed fast with his arms and legs, crabbing himself across the alley on his back, but they didn't come after him. The hooker and her buddy were long gone. He realized he was yelling, "Hey, help, hey," like a human car alarm. People were gathering. It took another hour to get the Germans sorted out. He was a businessman named Kramer over here on some kind of real estate deal. Kelly gave him his card, and on the back, he wrote whom to call at the cop shop in the unlikely event the guy wanted to report the incident. Then he took a cab back to his place. His jacket was shredded, his shoulders were raw, his head was pounding, and his left ankle hurt. He went to sleep for a couple of days, took hot baths for a couple more, then engaged in some light work at the gym. The ankle tended to get sore when he was on it for a while, but things were nominally okay. It just felt like he'd lost the beat, as if one unfortunate episode had knocked him off the wave. Now, he was headed for Sammy's Undersea Lounge, walking to get the ankle back in shape. The click of his heels on the pavement took on a reassuring rhythm, and his surroundings reconstituted themselves as the known world. At 62nd and Lex, he ducked into comfortable darkness. Nets festooned the ceilings, and the walls were hung with giant lobster claws, crab shells, sawfish bills, and stuffed octopus tentacles. A long aquarium behind the bar flooded the place with soothing blue light. Walking in there was like diving from the storm-tossed surface to the ocean's bottom. He stood in the sawdust, waiting for his cherry stone clams, and watched the hands of Norbert, the burly man behind the bar. 40 years immersion in cold water had turned them orange and pink, and prying shellfish apart had lumped layer upon layer of muscular gristle over the joints. To Kelly, the hands seemed like malign clams bent on destroying their brethren. With an instant's fatal pressure, they'd slip the edge of the knife between the two halves of the shell, slit the muscles that held it together, scoop the quivering body loose, and flip the empty upper lid into the trash. After this operation had been repeated a dozen times, the hands set the platter of clams on the bar. "Something the matter?" Norbert asked. "Man's inhumanity to clam," replied Kelly. And then there's another chapter. I think it's actually about Fred. Yeah, short. These are all short chapters because, oh no, it's about Gloria. These are all short chapters because nobody has attention. Cinematic. We got to keep it cinematic. This is called The Situation with Kelly. Norbert was a keen student of human nature. He knew it wasn't enlightenment that made Kelly the way he was. Although he sometimes took on the amnesia of the habitual drunkard, Kelly's condition, in fact, predated his alcohol habit. His father, a journeyman welterweight called Irish Johnny Kelly, had prepared for his only child's birth by falling down drunk. When the doctor handed over his newborn son, Johnny dropped him. Norbert knew the family, and that much was a matter of record. For the rest, he had developed a theory. Norbert considered it likely that after sliding headfirst through his father's slack grasp, the infant Kelly landed on the part of the brain that believes it knows what's going on and is always talking, trying to get control of things. The part that most people listen to when they think they're thinking. This normally dominant chatter center could have been damaged by the fall, so the other, quieter part of the brain that is constantly in communication with the rest of the body, guiding it down the street, recording details it does not see, causing the hair on the back of its neck to rise for no apparent reason, flinching at a muzzle flash. That part could have assumed the functions of the conscious mind. This, in Norbert's estimation, might explain why Kelly spent so much time in the state of concentrated attention that precedes thought, and so little in thought itself. Certainly helpful in escaping the knives of enraged transvestite hookers, the story related in detail to Norbert over Bloody Marys, but of little use when dealing in any non-physical way with those of his own kind. For Kelly, there were moments when the human universe was a distant galaxy. What fascinated Norbert was how his friend had compensated. Shunned as a young man for his strangeness and ignored by both his parents, Kelly found solace and companionship in his father's pulp magazines and trashy novels. From Hammett, he'd learned how to present himself with unflinching directness. Chandler taught him how to crack wise while doing so. Kane presented sex as a sadomasochistic rite, preferably enacted with distant relatives in abandoned churches. Spillane didn't teach him much of anything, but gave him an ideal of womanhood, the beat-up dame. Further study of these masters provided Kelly with a store of scenarios: the jealous husband, the rebellious son, the too greedy boss, the crooked official, the weak man brought down by his own vices. A thin array of archetypes for almost any human situation. A few empty years echoing his playground isolation on the police force in Bayonne had taught him how to maintain and operate a sidearm and keep his shoes shined. By then, he'd grown into a light heavyweight version of Irish Johnny in his prime, cat quick and possessed of a thunderous right. His education was complete. The results, to Norbert's continual surprise, were viable. Kelly was a private detective by trade and had managed for more than a decade, by means of his unthinking courage, physical genius, and limited repertoire of canned responses, not to starve. This raised an interesting possibility. Could it be that Kelly succeeded because most people's problems truly did conform to a few hoary stereotypes? If the husband was off the reservation, the official corrupted by his power, the wife murderously at the end of her rope, Kelly knew exactly what to do and say, chapter and verse. Was it possible that people, in all their twisted, self-absorbed dramas, were no more complicated than that? Norbert respected Kelly, no, loved him, because he had cobbled a persona out of ill-fitting parts and, through his own indefatigable will, was making the ramshackle contraption work. If only, he mused, trundling more shellfish from the cooler, the man wasn't so dense. If only he didn't act like such a jerk. But even that had his good side. No one ever overestimated him. And, like the blade of Norbert's shucking knife, the leading edge of Kelly's physical intensity had no thickness. It slid again and again through the tightest interstices of tough situations, drawing the rest of him with it.
Set out now in a box upon the sea.